Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Sunday, a man with an assault-style rifle walked into a Washington, D.C. pizzeria to self-investigate, he said, what was an utterly fake news story that Hillary Clinton had launched a child trafficking ring out of the Comet Ping Pong Pizza Parlor. He was firing that gun in a place where families go. It wasn't funny. Fake news has become a real problem in 2016. There's so much of it. So many people being swayed by it. It crowds out facts. It can corrupt democracy. This hour, On Point, fake news and what to do about it. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you see the problem? How do we rein it in? What do you think? What's the solution to the fake news that surrounds us? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us now from New York is Brian Stelter, senior media correspondent for CNN and host of Reliable Sources. Brian Stelter, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
With us from Palo Alto, California, Sally Lehrman joins us, professor of journalism ethics at Santa Clara University. She directs the Trust Project there, which is working to create tools to improve trust in the serious news media. Sally Lehrman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Brian, it's great to have you. Brian, we have news on this front. Just today, news out that, I guess yesterday reported today, that Donald Trump's outfit has fired the son of the National Security Council advisor, Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn. This is Michael G. Flynn, who had been working on the transition team. And he, I guess, was fired for retweeting the story about the child sex trafficking out of the pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., where we had a guy arrested with a rifle over the weekend. What's going on there, Brian?
That's right. The proximate cause of his removal from the transition effort is because he was promoting this Pizzagate conspiracy theory. Pizzagate is so ludicrous. I treated it as a joke until it became very serious on Sunday when this man apparently drove from North Carolina to D.C. trying to investigate this alleged child sex trafficking ring. Of course, this was made up out of nothing, invented online, but too many people online believed it. And some now believe that what happened on Sunday in real life was all just part of the cover-up. So anyway, that's what Flynn's son was suggesting. He, under pressure from the news media, really had to step down. And apparently, according to some of the reports, the president-elect himself insisted this man be removed.
So all the way to Donald Trump. And, I mean, this got people's attention, Brian, because what? Because the consequences were so real. A guy standing in a restaurant where kids and families go and firing off his assault-style rifle.
Fake news, real gunfire. You know, that's the bottom line about this story. And I think in our guts, we all know that even though this was an isolated incident, we all feel like this is going to happen again and again, that things like this are going to happen more and more often because the internet, the same tool that gives us instant access to every fact the world has ever known, also gives us access to all of these lies. It's so easy, and it's getting easier to wall yourself off in these digital echo chambers, these digital swamps, where you can only believe an alternate reality, an alternate view of the world. And of course, Donald Trump himself has bought into some of these conspiracy theories in the past, has promoted fake news stories in the past. So even though we see the transition taking action against one very low-level figure, the son of the incoming national security advisor, there's a much broader issue here about who in positions of power sometimes buys into these stories and what we can do as citizens to try to push back against that.
Sally Lehrman, of course, there's social media out there, but it's been out there for a while. Why the explosion of fake news this year and attention to it this year, 2016, Sally?
Well, the technology has changed a bit, and I think that because it's just the election cycle, there's so much more at stake and a lot more people who are very good at manipulating social media, potentially doing that, and also because I think of the sort of divisiveness of the election overall, people who may not even have thought about the quality of the news they were retweeting or posting socially may have gone ahead and pushed, been part of pushing fake news out there. Now, the truth is that fake news has been with us for quite some time, and as social media and other people find their news on social media and other sources other than picking up the paper, then or listening to the radio, then it becomes more difficult for them to be able to discern between quality news, poorly sourced news, fake news, outright media intended to incite. So I think that's why we see this acceleration, and we actually need to do something about it.
Brian, who is pumping all this stuff out? There's such a volume of it now, and it seems tailor-made, sort of, you know, to hit right on somebody's hot button every time. This is not just random, monkeys at typewriters. It's almost fiendishly tailor-made to get right into the bloodstream. Who's putting all of it out?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this maybe in terms of diabetes or in terms of cancer. I'm trying to think of the right ailment to describe fake news as, because it's been with us for a while. That's absolutely true. You can have a disease and not know it for a long time. This year, this has really been diagnosed. And partly that's because, as you said, there's been an explosion of it. There's been more of it. We're seeing more of the symptoms of this disease. And I think that's because, of course, of the polarized election, the polarized electorate. Very specifically, we saw an explosion in anti-Clinton pro-Trump stories this year. Stories that had no real connection to reality or just the thinnest connection to reality. Examples, of course, being, say, the Pope. The Pope endorses Trump. That was a big one on Facebook. It was spread in the weeks before the election. Of course, that was easily provably false. Those kinds of stories proved to be very popular online. Obviously, there were also stories that were anti-Trump that had no connection to reality that were popular online. But there was a real focus around these anti-Clinton, Clinton-hating stories. And Pizzagate's an example of that. So I think it's really important to note there are different shades to this, that there are stories that are what I call fake news, which is completely designed to manipulate you, to deceive you. These stories are trying to trick you. Where do they come from? Well, they could come from foreign government actors trying to spread propaganda, but they can also come from kids trying to make a quick buck. These are, in many cases, people in the United States or other countries who are trying to get page views and thus get advertising dollars. So they put up web stories that they believe will get widely shared. I've been fooled by those. I think everybody listening has probably been fooled at one time or another by some piece of fake news that looked true or people wanted to be true. So there's stories that are designed to deceive you, but then there's other shades of this, right? There's stories that are hyper-partisan that might have some truth in them, but also some lies. I think those are sort of the most troubling of all, because it's very hard to diagnose those sorts of stories.
I mean, I want to sit and think about potential responses to this, whether there are solutions out there. And of course, it's dangerous to get in here because you've got a First Amendment. You don't want to be restricting people's freedom of speech. And at the same time, fake news can be really corrosive to democracy. But to think about how we might address it, it really does seem to me to matter at some level where it comes from. I mean, you said foreign governments. I've seen Macedonia cited, Macedonia of all places, as a big source of origin. I don't know if that's... Listen to me. I'm about to say I don't know if that's true. I've seen it reported.
This is actually a story I wish I had written. This was a great BuzzFeed story revealing that kids, teenagers, young adults in Macedonia were some of the sources for these fake pro-Trump stories. Now, in that case, it wasn't the Macedonian government creating these stories. It was just teenagers or young adults trying to make a quick buck. And it worked. You know, if you get a million people to share your completely made-up news story, you're going to get a check from Google or a check from another advertising network.
Because
to all those
ads
views.
Run against it, and if people click on it, they're going to see those ads, and that's
exactly
revenue.
Exactly. Even if the ads are kind of sleazy and cheap, you still get a few pennies, and those pennies add up when you have millions of eyeballs. So in some cases, there's a business motive, and Google and Facebook have tried to address this. They've said they're going to try to weed these fake sites out of their ad networks. But then the more insidious issue here, thinking about foreign governments like Russia, thinking about intelligence services linked to foreign governments that have an interest in sowing confusion, in promoting stories that are fake. I recall the day that Hillary Clinton did, in fact, nearly collapse outside the 9/11 memorial. That was a true story, and there was true video about it. But then there were stories that went a step further, suggesting that she had Parkinson's or other ailments that were not true. Those stories, in some cases, did seem to come from Russian-affiliated websites, sites like Sputnik, and other sites with even looser connections. It's very very hard, Tom, but we have to figure out where the fingerprints are on some of these stories.
Sally, you know, a low-level infection the body can deal with. If you get too much, it can overwhelm our defenses. How serious is this to your mind? Is this like the old UFO stories in the tabloids at the checkout counter? When there's such a volume of it, what's the danger? What's the level of risk here?
Well, it is very dangerous, and I think that we have to be careful. We have to be more aware of it right now, because what we're seeing, as was just suggested, is this mixture of truth and falsehood. And BuzzFeed, again, did a really good analysis that showed that when you look at how much of a story is true and how much is in a gray area and how much is false, even when you look at high-quality, well-produced news, you still see some in that gray area because we do make mistakes. But when you look at hyper-partisan news or go to the fake news, then you see a little bit of truth mixed with a lot of questionable and then quite a bit of out-and-out fakery. And what we need to do as a public, and I'm speaking from a standpoint of journalism because I'm a longtime journalist myself, is offer a way to distinguish between these different kinds of news, and also not to not try to wrap them all in the same cloth, because there is a distinction between fake news and making a mistake. And lately we've been hearing, you know, when there's a little bit of a story wrong, then all of a sudden that's fake news, or if someone disagrees with it, that's fake news. And that in itself is very dangerous, because we stop believing in any sort of facts.
We want to parse this very, very well. Sally Lerman, please stand by there in Palo Alto, California, at Santa Clara University. It's great that you're here. Brian Stelter with CNN, senior media correspondent there, host of CNN's Reliable Sources. I mean, we have news right now from Reuters. The headline here is about Pope Francis telling a Belgian Catholic weekly today that spreading disinformation, quoting here the Pope, was probably the greatest damage that the media can do. And using communications for this rather than to educate the public, the Pope is now saying, amounts to a sin. Of course, one of those fake news headlines that came out during the election campaign season was Pope Francis shocks the world, endorses Donald Trump for president. That was fake. 100%. The Pope now calling the misuse of communications a sin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about fake news and what to do about it. Suddenly it feels like it's all over, like it's hurting us, confusing us, dividing us. How do we knock it down, knock it back, and do that with full respect for the First Amendment, a pretty important piece of work in its own right? Brian Stelter is with us today, host of CNN's Reliable Sources. Sally Lerman is with us from Palo Alto, Santa Clara University, professor of journalism ethics there. She's working with the Trust Project. We'll look at that. Philosopher Michael Lynch joins us in just a moment, and you can join us as well. Do you see fake news picked up, magnified, repeated, working its way into our important public conversations these days? I mean, it's always been there in scruffy tabloids at the checkout counter. Does it feel like it's everywhere now? What do we do about it? How do we stop it? What's the best way to counter fake news? Over the weekend, the guy with the gun at the pizza parlor in Washington that was the center of a fake news Pizzagate story. Hey, that was bunk, but there were real people there, real families, real kids. There he was self-investigating this with his gun. The White House daily briefing on Monday, here was White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest.
Even without knowing precisely what those motives were, I think there's no denying the corrosive effect that some of this, of these false reports have had on our political debate. And that's concerning in a political context. It's deeply troubling that some of those false reports could lead to violence.
Maybe they didn't there, but there were a lot of police, and it's a lucky thing they didn't. Of course, these things spread, and all kinds of motives here. People have been making money by putting out headlines that grab attention. You click on that, you're off to an ad. They make a little bit of money. Here's Justin Kohler. He's the owner of Disinfo Media, Inc. This is a company that writes fake news stories. And he told NPR last month that the fake news stories spread so well, he said, because they fit into existing conspiracy theories. Like a fake story one of his writers wrote saying that an FBI agent who leaked Clinton emails was killed.
The people wanted to hear this, you know, so all it took was to write that story. Everything about it was fictional, the town, the people, the sheriff, the FBI guy. And then, you know, our social media guys kind of go out and do a little dropping it throughout Trump groups and Trump forums. And boy, it spread like wildfire.
Wildfire. And suddenly it's all over. And we've got surveys saying American people who see this stuff, and it's a fair number of people, there's a tendency to believe it. I mean, we're talking about more than half the people believing some of these biggest headlines that came out during the campaign season. FBI Director Comey puts a Trump sign on his front lawn. Fake. 81% of people in the survey said they believed it. Brian Stelter, what about the big platforms for this themselves? Is that a place to look for somehow reining this in? Is there a way to rein it in without doing more damage to the First Amendment than what you cure or address by tamping it down?
Well, I would say private companies, for better or worse, can do whatever they would like to do with regards, for example, to what shows up in your Facebook news feed. Of course, algorithms control what shows up in your news feed. Facebook can choose, if it wants to erase every single story with the word Trump. Now, that would, of course, be disturbing. It would be inappropriate, and people would quit Facebook if that was to happen. But Facebook does have a lot of power in this conversation. So does Twitter. So does Google. These tech giants have a lot of influence, and they are struggling with this today. They are struggling with it every single day, trying to figure out what the right answers are. There's, of course, also responsibility for newsrooms, for big media companies like CNN and NPR and elsewhere. And then, of course, there's an individual responsibility. This is ultimately about users who should refuse to be confused by the nonsense online. Unfortunately, too many people want to believe these stories, whether they're anti-Trump, anti-Clinton, anti-whatever. You know, people do want to sometimes buy into conspiracy theories. So what we desperately need is more media literacy, more civic literacy, and unfortunately that's a very long-term solution to a problem that's with us today.
Refuse to be confused. I mean, it's easy to say, but it can get hard to actually pull off with all the headlines out there. We had there was a panel discussion last week with Facebook's Vice President Elliot Schrigg. This was at Harvard. And he said that the Facebook team there was originally not seeing Facebook as a news distribution platform. But now, he said, and this is just last week under with all this concern about fake news, he said Facebook is rethinking what they should take down or leave up, the content based on newsworthiness, a criteria they did not use before. Here's Schrag.
For so long, we had resisted having standards about whether stuff was newsworthy. Because we wanted that, we did not consider ourselves a service that was predominantly for the distribution of news. But that was wrong. And so we're now in the process of including more and more content that might otherwise be taken down, but that has a newsworthiness value to justify overriding standards.
I'm not sure. It's hard to parse what he actually means they're going to do or they are doing this.
Yeah.
Sally Lerman, what about the distribution platforms themselves? We can look at building sort of civic awareness of what real news is, but you know what the flood, the tidal wave of content is out there. If they're pumping out everything willy-nilly into so-called news feeds, is there something that can be done? I don't know how you counter that. What can be done at that level, Sally?
Yeah, well, so we're working at, I guess you would say, on all three levels. The idea of the Trust Project is to make it easier for both the public to see and tell the difference between high quality, poor quality, and fake news, and also for these algorithms to give signals back to the algorithms so that they're able to distinguish, because they're also faced with a flood of information, and they're looking at the algorithms are trying to, they're always updating their algorithms to try and assess that, but they need some help. So we're working with news organizations around the world, mostly Europe, U.S., and Mexico, to think about what is distinctive about quality journalism and how can we show our work? Because to be honest, part of the fault lies with us, with the media, because we haven't always met the public's needs and we haven't always been forthright and clear about how we go about reporting, and trust in news has declined precipitously. It's been its lowest point now since Gallup started measuring it back in 1997. And so we have to ask, well, what's going on? And we also have to note that there's a connection to fake news, because if you don't trust the news, why bother thinking about what you're passing on? So the thought is, we went out and talked with members of the public, and I am encouraged by what we heard from members of the public in these in-depth one-on-one interviews, because people do want to be informed. We found many people felt it was a civic duty to be informed, and they went to a lot of work, frankly, to try and cross-check their sources of information and figure out what's really going on in the world and in their communities. So what we've done is connected what we understand to be what the public needs and values in news, and when they trust it and when they feel their trust has broken, connected that up with traditional journalistic values, brought together news organizations to think about what are indicators that we can use to show our work and be more transparent about journalism so that the public can have these tools to see the difference, and the algorithms will also be able to discern the difference.
I'm not sure how to boil that down. Are you saying that you're going to have a trail of work that is reporting behind the story that comes out that people can have some access to, so they can see it isn't made up out of whole cloth? I mean,
a little bit. So let me give you some examples. So we call them our indicators of trust, and what they are. People want to know more about the news organization itself. So one indicator would be best practices. Do you have an ethics policy? Do you have a diversity policy? Corrections.
Diversity policy.
This is something
that's important, but how is that important in terms of fake news?
Well, it's important in the sense, so that's just one indicator.
Okay.
And all those indicators are important in the sense that we have a commitment to reporting fully and accurately on the news of the day, on all the components of society.
I mean, I get it. I want to look more at that, but Brian, this is pretty problematic when they... Professional news media itself, first of all, it's facing its own trust issues, and it's facing big financial issues. The business model of journalism has been so eroded. You've got Senator Claire McCaskill out of Missouri saying the biggest crisis facing our democracy is the failing business model of real journalism. If they can't staff up their newsrooms sufficiently, how do they compete with this tidal wave, this tsunami of fake stuff coming in?
I think what Sally's saying about trying to help consumers identify what real sources are and what high-quality sources are, it is a big part of solving this puzzle.
Yeah.
I would note, let's go back 20, 30 years. There's been a concerted effort to delegitimize real newsrooms by some in Congress, by other politicians, largely on the right, but sometimes on the left, a systemic effort to say the real news is biased, the real news is fake, the real news is not trustworthy. And that came to a head with Donald Trump systematically saying for 18 months, do not believe a word the media tells you. That, of course, is a destabilizing force. It causes people not to trust real sources and then be more likely to trust fake sources, the BS they see on their Facebook feeds. So I think we should acknowledge that structural dilemma. And yet, newsrooms, of course, sometimes have played into that problem by falling down on the job, by not doing enough soul searching, by sometimes coming across as biased or incomplete. So there are issues we've got to look inward at. I'll give you one short example. I noticed a piece of fake news about me this week. It's on some random website you've never heard of, but it's being shared on Facebook. This is really bad because it has one paragraph of real things I said on CNN,
okay,
and then four paragraphs of made-up quotes.
Wow.
And how is a person who sees this on Facebook supposed to know the difference? Well, unless you go and dig into the deepest, darkest part of CNN.com, you won't even be able to find what I really said. The video is hard to access as well. So even if you wanted to know the truth, it would be hard to find. So yes, there are things newsrooms can do to make the truth more accessible. But these are very hard problems to combat, and I frankly feel like a bad guest, Tom. I don't think I have good answers, and I don't think anybody has good answers to fully solving the problem.
And we feel the need, but of course, then there's the issue of do people even agree on what's fake or the importance of facts? Sometimes that hasn't been clear. There, we had Donald Trump's former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski last week. He was at also at Harvard and talking about the media's problems during the election cycle. He said he said the problem was they believed Trump or wanted to look for the facts in what he had to say. It was the problem, said the former campaign manager of Donald Trump, was the problem was with the media. Here he was.
This is the problem with the media. You guys took everything Donald Trump said so literally. And the problem with that is the American people didn't. And they understood it. They understood that sometimes when you have a conversation with people, whether it's around the dinner table or it's at the bar or it's wherever it is, you're going to say something, and maybe you don't have all the facts to back that up.
Okay. But there we are. We're talking about a candidate for the president of the United States, now president-elect. Don't take it so literally. All right. Michael Lynch joins us right now from Storrs, Connecticut, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut, author of The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. Michael Lynch, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
You're a philosopher. What's the net effect of this confusion about what's fact and what's not?
Well, the net effect is that it's eroding appeals to principles like truth, objectivity, and evidence in the public sphere. It's eroding our faith in those sorts of principles. And it's spreading confusion. I think one of the real harms, and both Brian and Sally were getting at this, one of the real harms behind fake news is not just that some people are believing these outrageous stories, and of course, you noted right at the top of the hour, some people actually do seem to be believing these outrageous lies about having to do with the pizza.
Quite a lot of people, the survey suggests.
Quite a lot of people, right, and that's really bad. Fake news, real guns, as Brian said. But there's another problem that's I think really needs to be hit on here, and that really, really is important, and that is that it's also eroding people's basic commitment to things like truth and evidence, because they start to have the sense that Brian was saying, that it's so hard to figure out what's true. And once you get into that position of saying, well, it's just so hard to figure out what's true, you might, on the one hand, you might feel like, well, I'm just going to give up. I'm going to stay at home, check out, and leave the floor to the extremist. On the other hand, you might just dig in and say, I'm just sticking with the facts that I have, and I'm not paying attention to any sort of attempt to provide me with counterexamples or evidence. Both of those attitudes are super corrosive of democracy.
We've got Marty Baron at the Washington Post, the editor there, saying, if you have a society where people can't agree on basic facts, how do you have a functioning democracy? If they check out and give up on even knowing basic facts, same question in a bigger font. Carson in Atlanta, Georgia is calling. Hi, Carson. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I don't really have any solutions to offer, but it seems like one of the biggest problems here is just self-responsibility on the person who's actually reading these stories. One of your guests mentioned before that we should have more civic responsibility, and I think you should probably check the sources. Or just, if you're reading a report on Facebook, maybe not the best place to source your opinions on something as important as national matters.
Do you think people have the time and energy to run everything down that they see, Carson, to its source?
It's not hard to look where it's coming from. I mean, it's pretty easy to find the source. If you're not reading something that you've ever heard of, and it seems pretty far off and unheard of by you, and you've never come across this news source ever in your life,
yep,
it might be a good idea just to at least check that.
Sally Lerman, is personal responsibility going to solve this problem?
Well, I think it's a combination of effort on the part of everyone involved, whether it be the platforms or newsrooms or the public. And I do think that the caller is correct. It is personal responsibility in the sense that we do need to think about what we're reading, and everybody can easily get caught up into forwarding something that is untrue. But if we can provide, from the news media standpoint, if we can provide better signals of quality, I think we can make it easy for the public. So another one of the signals would be, who is the author? Information about the expertise of that person. Labels from the news organization. Is this piece of information, is it news? Is it analysis? Is it opinion? So little by little, we make it easy to discern the distinction between quality news and poor quality news or fake news, and the public becomes more familiar with different modes of news, and we're more transparent with the work that we're putting into it. Because, well, frankly, some types of news get more work than others. Some are standing on more solid ground than others. So we need to be more transparent about that and share our work.
I mean, Michael Lynch, it seems we need systems for this, because right now you can say personal responsibility, but the tide of stuff on social media is so great, on the internet is so huge, it sort of overwhelms a lot of people's capacity for discernment.
It does overwhelm people's capacity, but I agree that we can't excuse ourselves from our participation in this. I think one thing that we can do is that hasn't been mentioned, but I think is really important, has happened over the last couple of days, is to call out people, especially high-profile tweeters, including @RealDonaldTrump, who are purveying false information. And I think it's really important for us to, as you did at the top of the hour, call people out on that. I think it's also important to realize that in the social media atmosphere that we're in, people participate in their life on the internet, and sometimes regard it in a way as if it's separate from reality.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org. Org number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about fake news and what to actually do about it. Suddenly it feels like it's all over. It's been a big factor in this election season. The internet, of course, turbocharges its transmission, its production, its distribution. What do you think? What's the best way to counter fake news? Could we stop it at its source? Can it, should it be reined in by Facebook, Google, the big social media platforms? How do we clean up our news landscape without abusing the First Amendment? And what's the cost if we don't get a handle on fake news? Sally Lerman's at Santa Clara University. She's working on the Trust Project, trying to figure out how to embed signals in news stories that people can track back to judge their credibility. Michael Lynch, he's a professor of philosophy who's thinking about all this at the University of Connecticut. Brian Stelter is with us, host of CNN's Reliable Sources. He's been right in the thick of all this. We've got a lot of callers for all three of you. Let me go to Brendan in Springfield, Illinois. Brendan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling in response to I think a lot of the internet news and the stuff that's coming out, the fake news, is in response to the media. I think that.
What do you mean by that, Brendan?
Well, I think of it. All media tends to have a bias. Whether you're talking about Fox, whether you're talking about CNN, they can choose what we're calling spin now. They can choose how to spin that story, and it seems like certain stations, whether it be Fox or whether it be CNN, NPR. They all have a certain way of spinning stories, in order to influence their consumers, the public.
So where do you go with that, Brent? I mean, we can talk about that, we can debate that, but where do you go with it?
I think it's basically up to the public, where you have to compare stories, the same story, from different points of view. You have to look at that, the story that you heard on Fox, you have to compare it with the same story that you heard on CNN, and then go to this Facebook media and compare it with some of the Facebook.
But what about straight up bunk, straight up bull that's put out there? Absolutely untrue stuff that's put out with a full-blown headline and gets in the bloodstream. What about that?
Well, honestly, that's the public's fault. I mean, they need to look at these sources, look where that news source is coming from, and maybe on from now on, like one of your people on there were saying,
yep,
maybe we need to be more show more where the news is coming from, who our donors are in the media, who's backing that article.
It gets complicated when you start sort of getting into some sort of moral equivalency or fake news bias spin. Michael Lynch here, a caller, suggesting fake news is in a way a kind of guerrilla action against embedded media bias. What do you think of that construct?
I don't think that most of the outrageous fake news stories that have been making real news headlines recently are guerrilla actions. I think they're actions either by people who are interested in spreading propaganda and deceiving people, or they're folks that are, as Brian said, kids out to make a quick buck. I think what the caller is suggesting, and I think has more truth to it, is that people have been saturated by a hyperpartisan media environment. And being saturated in that hyperpartisan media environment, they begin that hyperpartisanship tends to get people to mistrust all the sources. And so they tend, as I said, to actually become more confused. And confusion is just as bad as believing fake things. It causes people to check out or to dig in farther.
We've got here on Twitter, we've got J. Meg saying, fake news, and many question marks. Wasn't it called propaganda up until last week? Sort of a rhetorical reframing. I mean, Brian, is this kind of subversion propaganda at work?
Some of it is, and we do need to be using the word propaganda more often for some of this. You know, I think these websites, the one I was describing that wrote a stupid story about me that made up quotes this week, that's not propaganda. That's just stupidity. That's just tweaking me. That's just trying to get Facebook shares.
Trolling.
But when trolling is actually the best word for it. But when it comes to foreign government actors, security services for other countries, creating articles and promoting them through botnets on Twitter, yes, that is a form of propaganda. And we need to, like I said, have a better sense of what that is so we can call it what it is. I've started coming to use the terms information warfare to talk most broadly about this because we are looking at information warfare in this Trump age. It didn't start with Donald Trump, but clearly that's what we're seeing right now. And people in power benefit from the kind of confusion that we're seeing online today.
I mean, you can take it so far here. You could talk about information warfare. You've got Alex Jones, this conspiracy theorist, who does InfoWars show, saying 9/11 was an inside job. The Fort Hood shootings were staged. And a lot of people listen to him. This is him in August, late August, talking about people associated with Hillary Clinton, he likes to say, that died under suspicious circumstances. None of this was about facts, about proven facts. It's just outrageous assertion, but these things get currency. Here's Alex Jones. Hate to even play it, but you have to have a sense of what's out there.
It would take hours to chronicle the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that have been mysteriously murdered, gunned down, choked to death, drowned, cut into pieces since the Clintons were running for governor, right through president, right through the State Department to today.
Okay, I don't even know where to begin. And there's the First Amendment.
But I agree, you do have to play it. You have to play it because this is slickly produced. You know, Alex Jones can look like CNN when he wants to. He can sound like NPR when he wants to. And that is incredibly dangerous.
Joe in Austin, Texas. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment about the what I call propaganda. I know that it's just referred to basically as stupidity and how it's influenced even an older generation. My family goes back into Texas history since Texas was formed as a republic.
Yep.
My father, who is in his 80s, was highly influenced by this media and basically, for lack of a better way to put it, preached the Trump doctrine to all of his friends and basically hundreds of followers on Facebook. And I just kind of had to shake my head at it because, after checking on some of the facts and stuff like this, it was not true at all. And I'd just like to hear how y'all think that has, influenced the election.
Well, Joe, we'll do that. But you said your dad is 80-something. When he's going through, I don't know if it's a Facebook feed or whatever it is online, is he capable or ready and willing to track down the credibility of those sources, or is he just snapping up the headlines and rolling?
I believe that he's really just snapping up the headlines and rolling. This rhetoric is supported by, people in his community also, and he is a very conservative I would say Christian type Republican.
Okay.
And he's always been this way. But he just basically was saying how evil the Clintons were and a lot of this, what I call malarkey, for lack of a better term.
Buying it, passing on, it sounds like your dad's the kind of guy who votes, and good for him, but we hope that votes are based on or based in an informed public. Michael Lynch, this can take on a kind of gale force wind currents of its own here once this stuff starts moving.
That's right. I think that, and that's one of the things that so many of us are worried about, is that the gale force wind of disinformation that's sweeping across social media right now gets people to vote on bad information, maybe not vote at all because they check out, but can also, getting back to the point about propaganda, can cause propaganda to get its hooks in us in ways that we wouldn't have thought possible beforehand. Propaganda in a democracy, propaganda works differently in different forms of government. It works differently in totalitarian governments than democracy. But in democracies, propaganda works by cloaking itself in the ideals, democratic ideals. And this is what's so subversive about fake news and makes much of it, not all of it, into propaganda. Because what it does is it cloaks itself in the ideals of objectivity and evidence, even while at the same time, by its very existence, it undermines those ideals. That's what's really, really terrifying about this. Goebbels once famously said that, you know, the irony about democracy is that it lent its very ideals were those things that undermined it.
Let's have our antenna way up here. Yep, that's scary. Jim in Waltham, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Great show as always.
Thank you.
Three quick stories, fake news stories. Hundreds of Muslims dancing in the street in New Jersey celebrating the 9/11 attacks. That millions of votes were fraudulently cast in this recent presidential election, and without them, Donald Trump would have won the popular vote, and that global warming is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. This is just three fake news stories, and they all came from the same source, the president-elect of the United States. How much do people, I mean, I don't think people are stupid. I don't think a lot of people had the world pulled over their eyes by these stories, and yet the public has elected this guy anyway. How much is the public showing us that they value the values of credible, responsible journalism with their actions in this last election?
People have their reasons for voting, but, I mean, those three stories, they're kind of undeniable where they came from. They came from Donald Trump. Sally Lerman, maybe the American appetite. This is a tough question, but maybe maybe people don't want the truth.
Well, as I said, I mean, on the one hand, I think people, there was a sense that some of the vote did not have to do, or there wasn't a direct connection between what we were hearing as terms of facts about the different candidates and how people were voting, because they were voting from their heart and from values that they felt that these candidates represented. At the same time, what we're hearing from when we go out and talk to members of the public is that they really do care about information and they really do want to get it right, that there's a sense of civic responsibility. Those are the people who are paying attention, the people that are calling into your show. There is a contingent of folks who are repelled by the news, are disenchanted, are just completely disengaged because they've bought into this idea that the media isn't truthful, that it's all biased. So why pay attention? Or it's all negative. So there's a very emotional reaction of negativity toward the news. And that's one of the harder nuts that we have to crack, because those are the folks who aren't paying any attention to whether it's true or not, because they're just not listening and they probably are just forwarding whatever matches their preconceptions.
Neil in Savannah, Georgia. Neil, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment was just that one aspect of these stories that seems particularly nefarious or damaging is that they have sort of baked into them the idea that any attempt to disprove them or offer counter evidence is in fact just an effort to cover them up.
Yes, that's the kind of vibe around a lot of these. If you refute it or try and refute it with facts, you're just another political player. And pretty soon we're out where everything is just a big blur. Brian, we're near the end of the hour, and I'm still looking for, and I know Sally's working on this, and she's working hard and systematically on it. But how do we put up some walls here and do it with modesty? Because, I mean, when people talk about media bias, it'd be a fool to say that there's no such thing.
Yep.
Spin, of course, there's been spin. And yet we have a tradition of going for the facts. And the facts, reality, does have a way of coming out to bite us. It can bite us as a country if we float off into just a big ball of nonsense here. How do we redirect toward facts?
I'm trying to come up with an optimistic thought for the end of your hour, and I'm afraid I'm going to come up short. But I do think there's more that newsrooms can do. You know, you're talking about the role of the media here, and there is more we can do more proactively to sometimes get ahead of these lies and get ahead of the misinformation by trying to both report the truth and explain how and why we report the truth, right? There's more we can do, as Sally was saying, to document how we do our work. But I also think this is a moment I'd love to see Silicon Valley apply startup ideas to the news business on this front. What kind of new kinds of news operations could be invented in the Trump age to respond when he lies about millions of illegal people voting? I was on vacation last week when that particular lie came out. But I was so frustrated seeing some of the headlines in local papers where I was just repeating the lie as if it could possibly have some credibility. We've got to figure out a better way, with modesty, as you said, to stand firm on the truth. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of optimism right now about what we can do. But I'm glad we're talking about it, because let's be honest, 6 months ago, we weren't talking about this problem the way we are today. So at least now it is on the table for conversation.
Sally, you're out in Palo Alto, Silicon Valley way. Do you hear a commitment out there for them to try and work with this? Or are they just going to pump out whatever and make money on the ads that go with it?
Well, I will say that I definitely feel a commitment, because we've got, with the Trust Project, we have 70 news organizations participating, and three major news delivery platforms are also participating. So Google.
Name them. Who? Google? Who else?
Google is one of the funders. Twitter came to our recent event and helped the news organizations try to work on this problem, and Facebook also participated by video conference. So I think they're definitely interested in engaging with us. There's a conference that Google is putting on right now, that's why I'm in Palo Alto today, where journalists are talking with them about how to address this, among other things. Another element that's important when you talk about reaching out in this area with humility, there are things that we can improve about our practices and that we really should be doing, and that is be more transparent, like Brian was saying, and show our work, but also make sure we're covering all of American society, because part of why people tune out of the news is because they feel that they don't feel see their lives represented in the news. They don't hear their voices. And when we talk to folks, we hear that, and we saw that in this election. People were saying, we don't see ourselves reflected in the news, so why should we even believe it? So we can go back to some of our traditional values and just do our job better, and I think that would help as well.
Self-reflection on all sides in order here, but bottom line, without a commitment to facts, we are in trouble. The world ultimately works on facts. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Sally Lerman at Santa Clara University, joining us from Palo Alto in California today. Sally, thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Michael Lynch, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut. Michael, thank you for your insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Brian Stelter at CNN, host of CNN's Reliable Sources. Good luck. Thanks a lot, Brian. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.